going back to a time when it was incredibly expensive, for example, to write things down, right? Before you have the printing press, when you need to make papyrus, and when you need to, you know, have scribes write these things. Why is it that people felt it was important enough to reproduce this text, to earnestly teach it to their young?
Dash, you were one of my earliest guests on this show, way back in 2023. Can you believe it?
Wow.
The old days.
Already 3 years ago.
What's been your journey since then with Bitcoin? How do you see it now?
So back then I was probably right in the, I was like 100% maxi phase, like running nodes, and I think I even had like six nodes running at one point, right? Lightning nodes, I was doing all that. I was doing circular economy stuff. We probably discussed that on the show, right? Yeah. Running meetups and things. And I got a little bit burnt out with that. Shortly after probably we did the podcast, I don't know. It's maybe within a few months, right? And there was some disagreements within the local group that we were in. And just, I think a lot changed anyway within Bitcoin. And for me, you know, I guess to summarize the last few years is like, I'm still interested in Bitcoin. I still see Bitcoin as a very useful tool. I think it's probably the best investment one can make. But I have real reservations as Bitcoin is anything kind of beyond that. I think people, you know, they extrapolate beyond that, and they start to talk about Bitcoin as some sort of quasi-religion. And they start saying, you know, there's this whole thing in Bitcoin, the Bitcoin fixes this idea, where I think people can become a little deluded and think that Bitcoin's going to fix things that it just can't possibly fix. And I think, you know, I came to that conclusion that Bitcoin was, you know, it's probably the best money. It's probably the best store of value. One of the reasons I think I know that is the same reason I know that Apple stock is a good investment, right? Because I hate Apple. Absolutely despise them as a company. I hate giving my money to Apple, and yet every time I try and buy a new computer, I bought one late last year, I sit down, I do the comparison, you know, I look at all the alternatives, and I end up buying a Mac again, because, you know, there's just no other game in town for a computer. I think it's the same with Bitcoin. I think when you sit down and I'm sick of running nodes, I'm sick of like worrying about privacy, I'm sick of worrying about, you know, government policy towards this thing. I'm sick of like $5 wrench attack threats and all these other things, like quantum computing, FUD, all this stuff. And you're like, I really like not to own Bitcoin and divest away from it. But then you sit down and you look at the alternatives, and you're like, kind of,
this is it.
I'm kind of stuck here. Now, you know, there are people who will say that there are derivatives available now for people who don't want to mess around with those things I just mentioned. So, for example, there's MicroStrategy's preferred stocks and the MSTR stock, etc. And we can maybe get a little bit into that. But, you know, I think at the very minimum, even if you do have this, diversify, and you maybe look at things like MicroStrategy, you're still going to need an allocation of it. Like the number is not zero for on-chain Bitcoin for anybody. I don't think that makes sense. And you know, and that's despite me. I wouldn't say I hate Bitcoin, but like I'm definitely tired of a lot to do with Bitcoin. I'm kind of tired of a lot of the stuff that goes on in Bitcoin.
Okay, well let's dive into that because there's a lot there. So maybe this reflection, this pause that you have right now, maybe we can contrast that with how you got into Bitcoin,
right?
And maybe the climb up that mountain.
Yeah.
So very broadly, as much as you can share, I mean, what was your initial interest in Bitcoin and what got you into it?
Sure. So for me, it was interesting because I didn't hear about Bitcoin until quite late. And it was, Andreas Antonopoulos, right? It was on Joe Rogan episode, which I'd listened to kind of late. It was, you know, it was when Bitcoin was, you know, fairly mainstream already, but I hadn't heard of it. I'd been in Japan, I'd been enjoying my life. I don't know, even though I was in open source software, like I'm a Linux guy, You know, I've always been into sort of open source and stuff, but I just never came across. I think because it was more like back then, maybe it was more like the finance bros who were talking about it or into it, or it was a, you know, I don't know. The circles that I were in just wasn't aware of it. And then I heard Antonopoulos talk about it on the Joe Rogan show, and I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. That's interesting. You know, so I think I kind of lament that a little bit, because I think, well, if I'd have heard that same pitch, you know, earlier, I'd have got in earlier, you know, right? Back when it was like in the hundreds or tens of dollars or whatever, and that would have been great. But then I also think, well, no, because you'd have sold at the first 2x and regretted it for the rest of your life. So, you know, maybe I got in at the right time. But you know, I got in relatively late. After the Antonopoulos thing, and it just made sense from a kind of an open source guy, you know, someone who's a little bit technical. I wanted to play with it. I wanted to see how it worked, you know. So I did. I just got hold of a very small amount of it, and I was mainly, like, to be honest, interested in the technical side. I was interested in kind of the investment too. I'm not going to say it was zero, but it was more like 70% technical interest and 30% like financial. So I was mainly playing around with it. I was playing around with, like, running nodes. I read, Mastering Bitcoin by Antonopoulos? You know, I went through that, like, a couple of times, properly going through it, making sure I understood at the protocol level. And then just experimenting with stuff, you know, on the command line, and just, like, totally geeking out over it. And then, you know, the whole kind of madness in 2017 was happening. And again, I kind of missed a lot of this because I had just bought a very small amount just to play around with. And I wasn't really following the price, you know. And then one day, I just checked it, you know, whatever. I just checked it. And I had Ethereum back then as well. And I was like, this thing is like 5x since I last... It was ridiculous. And so obviously that piqued my interest in another way, right? Beyond the technical stuff. And then that's when I started to kind of started going down the rabbit hole in terms of listening to a lot of Bitcoin content, podcasts, YouTube, whatever. And that really opened the door, because that kind of, you know, led us into COVID, basically, because I was on that, you know, I was still kind of interested in what had happened. I was still trying to work it out. I was still trying to work out the technical stuff, but I was also, you know, obviously the price stuff was kind of interesting, and I was just like listening to so many shows, and that kind of got me thinking about a lot of things in terms of economics, in terms of how the monetary system worked, and then that all leading into COVID, right? When the COVID thing happened, and I was like, what is going on? This is insane. I think we've discussed this on the show before, but that was the kind of red pill moment for me. It was like, it kind of, COVID was like when I basically went from, in my opinion, being a complete NPC to being like awake to a lot that was going on that had just been completely hidden in plain sight prior to that. And Bitcoin just kind of gave me that frame of reference and that kind of, you know, whatever, to, I guess, that vocabulary to really start discussing it and thinking about it, and coming out on the other side a completely different person than I'd gone in.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah. It's a profound change, right? It's a transformation. Yeah. And I understand exactly what you mean. This relationship with the state,
yeah,
it's a question of money, of value.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of us were, through the COVID years, as you say, you know, we woke up to something.
Yeah.
The idea, at least, that there were bigger forces at play, that our narratives of the way we live were under threat. And it's interesting, though, and if you go back in time and look at people, you know, many, many decades ago who were asking similar questions, though.
Right.
And seeing that, you know, there has always been, I think, some critical analysis of the world we live in.
Absolutely.
But one thing that's quite powerful about Bitcoin is it's a very practical tool. It's something that you can do.
Yes.
And so have you reflected on that difference between kind of the theoretical mind game versus being able to run a node?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I haven't probably reflected on that enough as I should have. I think you're right. I think that's probably what's different, because you always had that, I guess, well, for want of a better word, like the conspiracy theory kind of thing, right? Where you could theorize, you could talk with your friends in a bar or whatever about how the world was really run, and but then there's nothing you could really do about it. The answer, I think, at the end of all of that was always, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know? And so you just, you enjoyed your grilling, you enjoyed your sports ball, and you just tried to get on with your life, right? Whereas Bitcoin actually gave us, was it the first time? You could argue like Linux. Like
computers.
You could argue like, because, you know, the whole open source thing, the whole, I don't know how much you know about like Richard Stallman and the whole, it was more about the licensing of software. And I believe it was him that came up with the GNU or the GPL, right? Sorry, the GPL. So like a copyleft kind of idea that, you know.
Free and open source.
Free
software.
And open source, but like, so what happened to him? He got screwed, basically. Like he shared some software with someone, some company, I believe it was, or he improved some software, something like this, and then gave it back to them. And then they took it and I think made that proprietary and wouldn't refuse to share anything back with him. And so he came up with this concept that this licensing where when it's copyleft, so it's not permissive, right? So something like the MIT license, for example, is permissive. You can do whatever you want with that. You can close source it. You can, you know, there's zero restrictions. But with something like the GPL, which is Linux kernel is under, that's once you've modified that code and you've issued a product, I guess, or you've launched a product, you have to make that source code available. That's part of the licensing. And you cannot arbitrarily decide to make that closed source after the fact. So that was very powerful in terms of licensing. And then you've got the likes of Linux that came along that then leveraged that. And it meant that, you know, the Linux kernel, this operating system kernel, became public domain almost, right? It was owned by everybody. Mm-hmm. And so anybody who then downloaded, used this on their own computer was then sovereign owner of their own computer to some extent. Now there's some caveats because hardware is obviously, you have proprietary blobs and you know, hardware is notoriously proprietary and difficult too.
There's a lot of hardware hackers out there though.
I mean, there are, yeah. Mm. Yeah, but I mean, so that exists in somewhat of a legal gray zone. But to a great extent, at least from the software stack perspective, you had sovereignty. You know, nobody could tell you what to do with your own machine. No, it wasn't permissioned, right? So there's that. I think that's, for me, probably the genesis of it all. And then, you know, Bitcoin, I think Bitcoin's under MIT, but Bitcoin's essentially in that same, I would argue, kind of movement.
Interesting. Well, there's a couple of things here. So I find this idea of practice and theory quite interesting because, believe it or not, Karl Marx actually had a lot to say about this. And I think this is one of the blind spots for a lot of Bitcoiners or a lot of people, in fact, is that there is historical precedent for understanding power relationships, understanding mm-hmm. the world around us. And I do think we do a disservice to ignore and put our head in the sand as to the historical literature on this. And so in particular with Marx, this, and obviously I'm not claiming, and maybe I have to disclaim, I'm not a Marxist, but you can learn a lot from his work.
Absolutely, yeah.
And one of these things is that the power, not of ideas, but of action.
Yes.
And this leads into something like Vladimir Lenin, a vanguardism of revolution, of doing something,
as opposed to
kind of the airy-fairy ideas of the intelligentsia.
Sure.
And I think, and when I say intelligentsia, you know, kind of the academics of people talking about things. And I think that's funny that the meme of the guy grilling the sausages and asking about the game is, in fact, I think, a Marxist statement in that he's referring to the lumpen, which is the people who are not willing or interested in the revolution. And so I think we're almost, and there's some things we can unpack here, and we're actually rediscovering power relationships. We're rediscovering the relationship between action and thought. We're reliving in this.
That's fascinating.
This interesting time.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think you've got
a point. We're rediscovering.
Right.
These kinds of ideas.
This is the kind of revolutionary aspect of Bitcoin, right?
Yeah. And the consciousness of, say, the banking class, which I find it very interesting. As you know, I've been diving deep into neoliberalism over the last few months.
I saw your post on Stack and News.
Thank you. I really do think there's a lot there to again look into. But the last 40 years, in fact, our lifetimes, have been encapsulated in neoliberalism.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, I think we can look at that in through the lens of someone like David Harvey, who wrote A Brief History of Neoliberalism. What is the power structure of the world today when there is a financial class who, through the powers of the banking system, through their centers of influence in London or New York, are able to affect the world? And I do think, absolutely, as Bitcoiners, we must look at the global financial crisis 2008 as the unmasking of that system where there's no free market. Those banks got bailed out, baby. And the money got, you know, they got their bonuses. And as I wrote about in that article, the money kind of evaporated. It went somewhere. And I think that maybe now isn't the place for, this discussion isn't the place maybe for a dive into neoliberalism deeply. But I think one of the outcomes we can recognize is that over the last 40 years, the development of financial tax havens, of financialization of everything, of derivatives of everything, that's in a sense an elite project to reform the way we own the world. And so to have something like self-sovereignty over your bitcoins, that makes it a revolutionary idea that you have money without a trusted third party, without any intermediaries. And that, I think, is revolutionary kind of thinking. Well, I mean, what do you think?
Well, there's a lot. There's a lot to unpack there. You've got me, because I'm still trying to process the stuff about the marks you were bringing up. But in terms of the... I mean, it's fascinating. I don't know if we could quickly go back to that and work our way through what you said, because... that whole action versus just ideas is fascinating to me. I said that I thought Linux was the genesis of that. Obviously, I think you're absolutely right that that's not the case, in that we have this precedent in revolutionary Russia, I guess. I guess if you dug into it enough, you could go back to the French Revolution, or maybe there's even prior examples.
Or the Enlightenment.
The Enlightenment,
perhaps.
Yeah, or even the Reformation, maybe to a large extent, right? Where, you know, this idea that if you took the Reformation as an example, that you could found your own church, right? You could people can just translate the Bible, right? This kind of the Reformation, obviously there was ideas, but there was action as well. And then, as you say, in the revolutions, to the point that the Bolsheviks, I guess, managed to seize power of the state. So there is this. There are these historical precedents for action. I guess people who can take these intellectual ideas and actually kind of run with them and make things happen in the world.
Well, there's also, I think, an interesting interplay with technology, and this is something that the sovereign individual writes about. And I think the sovereign individual is a very powerful text to analyze within neoliberalism, actually, as well. But the idea that history has a destiny, that technology and what the authors refer to as mega political forces, so bigger than politics, that the something like the environment or changes in technology, climate, these things are much bigger than politics, as in people to people.
That makes a lot of sense.
And so technology being one of those, whether we go all the way back to the agricultural revolution,
development
of farming, you know.
That was the original sin, right? Because then now you've got to defend that. And so now we have standing armies. And now if your standing army is bigger than, you know, neighboring states, then there's an incentive for them to form alliances and come in, and then we have war, global war, right? So I completely agree. I think, and then you take the Reformation, for example, well, that would be arguably the printing press that
technological
led to that, right? And then for Marxism, I wonder what the technological,
well, in a sense, he
communication
was,
technology.
I think he was referring to maybe the Industrial Revolution. So
Industrial
he was
Revolution.
Critiquing what was around him, which was urbanization mechanical factory work. And you know, that change was happening. And so again, that's where I think
technological change then led to the
what he's doing, and why I think it is valuable to read his work is to understand what he was seeing. You know, Marx and Engels were understanding what they saw happening in industrial Britain, and certainly, you know, your home country as the world's first industrialized country, places like London, Manchester were the beginnings of a revolution.
Yeah.
And we sort of forget this in our modern age, but somewhere like Manchester was the shining city on the hill,
Even
if it was covered in coal dust.
Yeah.
This was the development of technology that could reproduce widgets and make things in these dark, dim factories that were just not possible before. And I haven't really seen an awareness of that, I think, in our modern world, because we're now in the information age where most people have never been in a factory or understood its logic, the logic of time, you know, like the whistle blowing and tools down. That's not really a concept in the information age, because you're always carrying your work with you. But having done some book publishing before and being at the factory where they made the book, it was like, yep, the whistle blows and that second you put your tools down, because it's all about the repetition and the job. You'll always come back and be able to pick it up again. And so he was really referring to, I think, that technological change that was leading to a social change or political change.
It makes a lot of sense. And then so, like, bringing it back to Bitcoin, I guess, so some people might say, well, okay, so the technological innovation there is the kind of the difficulty adjustment plus proof of work, right? Solving the Byzantine generals problem and the blockchain, essentially. But I would argue that it's not. It's the revolution of technology is the internet, right? It's the information age, and then Bitcoin is just a part of that story. In that it was the first time we actually have digital scarcity, and once we have digital scarcity, it means we can do things online and in the virtual world that we couldn't do before. We can have a ledger.
Well, there's something about scarcity that prescribes. Or it endears meaning to action.
Yes.
There's consequences and there's limits, let's say.
You're imposing the constraints of the physical world onto the digital in a way, or you're even maybe Bitcoin is the marrying of the two, right? Because of the proof of work mining, you have this almost magical point of intersection between the digital world and the physical world. The two are brought together.
And I think what I'm seeing, and because I agree with you, over the last few years, my response, my kind of the signal that I'm getting from the popular discourse within Bitcoin communities certainly has been strained. I've read plenty about it, but I find there's just been maybe a confluence of X and engagement farming and a few other things
have
led to a bit of a moral hazard where it's just not that useful anymore to spend time in Bitcoin discourse.
It's a waste of time.
On Twitter, for example.
Yeah.
But that said, that doesn't mean that we don't have something profound here in front of us. And that's where I've spent the last probably year or two really going back into the classics of the history of economics, of philosophy, of political economy, and seeing that there's a lot there that maybe in a kind of an honorable, practical sense, it is a little bit elitist to dive into some of the literature that's been written before about money, and whether it's something like Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, whether it's Marx, whether it's the Austrian school, whether it's the Keynesian school. There's all these, you know, tomes that have been written about economics. Not that many people have time to read into that, but I think that it is actually something still there that we've got with Bitcoin that just hasn't maybe had the voice to really articulate it clearly, as maybe the logic has changed around value. You know, the price maybe isn't going to a million as quickly as people were hoping.
No.
A lot of the grifters have kind of moved on to something else.
Sure.
Or they're just talking to each other in this dead internet, you know, where there's just automatic bots.
Sure.
And all of this stuff. Is that obscuring the fact that there is, in fact, still a revolution here?
Probably, yeah. And as you say, so it's downstream from the technology. The technology is now... So I wonder how much this relates to Balaji's stuff about the network state. I don't know how much you've looked into that. He's got this idea that what we've got with the internet is essentially an emergent sort of... Well, how would he put it? I mean, he puts it more eloquently and people can look into it themselves, but it's something like the next phase or the what will replace the American hegemony is this competing, you've got this kind of, in his mind, China model.
China.
is, and then you've got the network state, which is the internet. And his idea is that, you know, ultimately the internet will sort of prevail, will sort of supersede, or it will replace the nation state, or the global hegemon. And
do you believe that?
I mean, maybe. I think it's a very interesting idea. It makes sense, but in terms of time frame, we could be talking 500 years. So I don't know how practical it is to really talk about it now.
I wonder. One of my discoveries, actually, going into this period of deep study into political economy and Bitcoin, is that certain things, including AI maximalism, ideas like the network state, and to be fair, even ideas like the sovereign individual, they, in my study, it seems that they all emerge from a sense of a neoliberal free market fundamentalist worldview. That is to say, the markets will always know what is right, that society and the way we configure our lives will move around, it will sort of evolve itself to meet the needs of the market. And I think there's, again, this is where I come back to neoliberalism, which at some point in the 1980s, we got given this new story around the way societies work, that governments are in fact inefficient, they cannot do anything properly, that you should be free to self-author your life and do what you want to do. And again, in the UK, New Zealand, our countries got reformed by neoliberal logic when something like the nation's, the network state, it actually completely throws out the idea of borders. It throws out the idea of the last 300-400 years of Western development, certainly. And I don't know if a lot of those guys have looked into it closely. They're kind of, it's almost like they're just sort of continuing the line of what they're seeing in front of them.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so it's in a short sense, it's like they, if I was to summarize it, it feels like they're kind of, I don't want to say wishful thinking, but they're sort of, you know, drawing the line of where they think things will go, when it seems like, if anything, you know, we're seeing the devolution of any kind of organized society in some parts of the world, and a very much an increase in state power in other parts of the world. And the sort of, it's not as simple as we're all going to have our computers and be self-sovereign. I don't know.
Yeah, no, you raise a very good point. And to maybe to build on that and kind of agree with you, if anything, in the West, we're seeing, as you say, the opposite trends, where the government is now...
Strongman, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure we're headed to almost sort of ubiquitous KYC, digital identity plus KYC on the internet. Now, again, you know, there's different. The internet is interesting because, you know, you have the likes of Facebook, and you know, even AI. So I was reading today that Claude, and I think all of the major labs now are introducing KYC for certain, if they detect certain usage patterns, right? So if you're using Claude to do some security research, let's say you're looking for vulnerabilities in a software stack, it'll prompt you to KYC with government ID, things like this, right? So obviously you'll have your permission, sort of government control, these places of the internet which are more mainstream. That's the trend, is absolutely towards that. It's becoming increasingly easy for the government to do this now. For example, in Japan, we have the My Number system, which is getting to be fairly mature now. So they've managed to have us now use this for our healthcare. We need, you're right. And then pretty soon your driver's license, everything will be. So that's, you know, definitely, there'll be, you know, the mainstream internet, shall we say, will be heavily KYC'd, heavily controlled by the government. But then I suspect you'll always have the free internet, and whether you call that the dark web or whatever, and you know, the kind of Wild West where people who know what they're doing can kind of write around things.
I wonder if I may paint a picture for you. I guess in this study, the idea that you can just run a node, that you have this ability to just do it, I think is one thing. But the other thing is, well, will people actually do it? And that kind of statement, I think, reveals maybe our background, in fact, which is that we do come from a democratic nation state kind of framework. I mean, it's our mother tongue, I guess. And so the idea that, well, you know, we're going to orange pill, we're going to mm-hmm. share this this good idea, we're going to show you how to do it, when actually, I mean, you talk about the neck tattoo, you know, brethren of your hometown. You know, are they going to do? Are they really going to? They're not going to do that.
Well, so just on. By the way, I don't agree with you that we live in democracy. So
okay.
So or maybe the definition of democracy. I suspect we don't share, right? Okay. So for me, you know, I've gone through the whole, as you know, Yarvin rabbit hole. You know. And I've come out the other side believing that, you know, democracy is not the, it's not ruling by the will of the people. It's ruling by people who claim to have that mandate, right? And so I don't see all that much difference between, you know, the US, Europe, New Zealand, and China, for example, and we can argue about that. But what one example would be around Bitcoin and use of Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, where in China, for example, these more autocratic societies, they'll just come out, I would argue, in a more honest way and say, well, you're not allowed to do that. And in the so-called, you know, democracies that we come from, they'll be far more subtle and I would argue far more insidious and mendacious, right? In that they will have tax treatments that just discourage use of Bitcoin as a medium of exchange because it's a taxable event and because you have to track your cost basis and because, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's just impractical to use Bitcoin as a medium of exchange. So these are examples of how our democracies achieve exactly the same net result as the so-called dictatorships or autocracies, just with more subtle, more insidious means.
Well, just pulling on that thread, though, I mean, I understand the Yarvin argument that there is a sense of powerlessness. I think that is true at this point in time, but when I look back, and again, this is where I think it ties into neoliberalism, which at that juncture mm-hmm. of the 1980s, off the back of the second oil shock, which incidentally was about Iran and the Iranian Revolution, mm-hmm. we saw this idea that the state couldn't do things, and you had people like Ronald Reagan saying, you know, what is it, the words you never want to hear. Right. I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And there was this quite concerted effort to denigrate the state, whereas if we look at the counterexample of, say, Fortress New Zealand in the 1970s, and I would argue the UK at the same time, that you had a generation that went through the war, they went through the Great Depression. They knew that unemployed men in particular were a danger to society, that if you had striking workers, if you had a popular unrest, you had a problem. And so there was a kind of a yin and yang. There was a social contract there around full employment. Yeah. The New Deal, you could argue, was the US. There was like a project there. But what's happened over time is the retreat of state power in lieu of private power. The government can't do anything anymore, really. It can blow people up. But its ability to create national infrastructure like it could in the 1960s.
Well, that's true, yeah.
Has receded. And so we sort of, it's almost become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I'm not a statist either, let me be clear. Right. But I think it's interesting that we argue that democracy has died, but, you know, it had to be alive at one point.
I disagree. I don't think it ever, on reflection. Okay. So as well as the Yarvin thing, I've gone down the elite theory rabbit hole as well, right? So you've got this this book called The Populist Delusion. It was published fairly recently in the last few years. But basically he just goes through and he talks about the elite theorists, you know, Pareto, being one that comes to mind, De Juvenal, I think was another. You know, I think, does he cover Schmidt in the, maybe he does. There's several he goes through. But basically his argument is this whole idea that, and to get back to your point about is the neck tattooed, you know, my brethren from back, are they going to be running now? Are they going to be doing anything? No, is the argument from the populist illusion. As you can probably guess from the title, it's this idea that the whole thing is ludicrous. The people aren't going to do anything. They will never do anything. They never have done anything. The argument of the book is everything is top down, right? So it's essentially, it has to be driven by elites, you know, a well-organized minority always rules over the disorganized majority. And so I'm completely now subscribing to that way of thinking. I think it's the only way that the world can actually be. And the whole idea of democracy is essentially as a huge psyop, which is used by the elites, like I say, to claim that they have this, you know, mandate from the people, the quote-unquote people. And the problem really with living in democracy, something I alluded to a little bit earlier, is it's just fundamentally more dishonest than an oligarchy. Oligarchy, I would argue, is the natural state of any organization. We live in an oligarchy. You know, the Russians live in an oligarchy. The difference is our oligarchy lies to us about this. And what's required is this kind of like constant propaganda and these constant psychological operations, these psyops, right, to convince us that we live in some sort of, you know, like free democratic society, when in actual fact, if we really look at it, if we really look at, you know, okay, well, am I free to use this software without KYCing, or am I free to use Bitcoin, you know, without incurring taxable events, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Or during COVID, was I free to go and have dinner with, you know, I remember speaking to my father during that period and him saying, I think it was his birthday or something. And he was like, well, we wanted to go around to your sister's for dinner, but, you know, unfortunately the government won't let us. Okay, so what was the difference between living in England and living in China, right? So it's the difference is that, you know, in the quote unquote West, and I would argue this goes back to essentially, it's kind of, obviously World War II, we hear about propaganda from World War II. Propaganda was something that happened in World War II, right? It was the Nazis did it, but we didn't do it. But if there's a few interesting things about that, the end of World War II, and I think it was Freud's cousin, who, he went to the US, and he was working in advertising, Madison Avenue, right? And he was instrumental in running this campaign which got women to start smoking. One of the big problems that the tobacco industry had, the problems, right? There was, they could only address half the market. Women wouldn't smoke. It was considered, you know, I guess, unwomanly or whatever. And he managed to work out a way to appeal to the subconscious of the female population, yeah, and encourage smoking amongst females. So what I'm trying to say is there's this history within the American machine, you know, the regime or whatever, of them in the private sector, and we can only assume also the public sector, of them understanding that mass communications plus this kind of intentional conditioning and running these cycle operations is an effective way to have the population do something you want them to do, right? And I believe that's what we live in. Well, that's what democracy is.
It's interesting you mention that because, again, another historical academic movement is the Frankfurt School,
okay,
which you mentioned that in maybe Bitcoin circles and you get and maybe a negative reaction, but they are worth studying because they are the ones who developed something like the hypodermic theory of media, which was that you could somehow inject an idea,
okay,
into society.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. When was that?
This is in the 1930s.
Okay.
And in a way, I've mentioned this before, but you know, I kind of got inoculated to a lot of these ideas because I went through that. I did media studies. I understood that lens, and I think it's a very powerful lens, as you say, the ability to manipulate. I mean, my creative work, I use that word manipulate, but in terms of how do you create a piece of media that can convincingly tell someone a story? In fact, how do you do sales? How do you do any of these things? But I would actually concede the point that I think we're actually on the same page with the democracy question.
Yeah.
There is a delusion, perhaps, that a passive kind of block of people somehow have any kind of power. And maybe this is where we look back to the sovereign individual, which is that seizing the means of production through something like industrial action, the coal miner strikes and the winter of discontent in the UK, or shutting down the Ford factory because you're not getting paid enough. That's the activation of what is possible with collective action. And so maybe there's a tension there where a large enough amount of people can actually sway the world.
If they're led by a counter elite, would be my point there.
Okay. If they're led by a counter elite, tell me more.
So I think this Pareto has this idea that, you know, you always have an elite, you always have an oligarchy, an elite running society, an organized minority, but it's not always the same elite. So you can have a counter elite coming along and displacing, you know. Maybe this is like Caesar crossing the Rubicon and, you know, these kind of events that can happen in history, right? So, you know, for example, it would be interesting to look, I think the example you gave was the Ford factory being closed down, but what you probably notice is that there'll be some sort of elite, counter-elite actor within that movement who is actually orchestrating it and is using the masses to affect some kind of
I'm willing to concede that people can be susceptible to advertising or not coercion, what would we say?
What, influence?
Influencers, right?
Right.
We live in the age of the influencer.
Right, right.
I'm willing to concede that point, but I guess it's like, what is the operational mechanism? It ends up, in these historical examples, being people. You're activating people to do something.
Yes.
And I'm willing to concede that, and that then means, okay, how does this relate to Bitcoin? How does this relate to what we're doing? Are we counter-elites when we start proselytizing Bitcoin, you know?
I mean, maybe. I would say an elite is somebody who can organize people to do towards some sort of task. So I wouldn't consider myself an elite. I'm just a pleb in a way that I don't have an army of people doing, you know. I'm not an influencer, right? Mm. So I don't think we're necessarily elites. And if you're not an elite, you're probably being influenced by one, or you're sort of waiting to be. So I don't know who the elites are within Bitcoin. I know that there's obviously been a big change since Trump's second term, and I would argue Trump is probably an example of a counter elite. Although again, I'm just speculating. I don't know for sure, but it seems to me that, you know, it's the Silicon Valley money and elites, Thiel, Musk, the kind of PayPal mafia, seem to be around Trump versus maybe the Democrats. It's more sort of, East Coast banking money. I have no idea. Something like that, right? Or is kind of emergent, you know, the new money, Silicon Valley versus the old money, New York banking or something. Yeah. And it seems to me there's a battle, or the battle maybe of our time is happening between those.
And we can't even really see it. We feel it, maybe.
Yeah, I guess it seems that something like that's going on, but you don't know for sure. And is that good for Bitcoin? I think Trump it seems the Trump administration is far better for Bitcoin than the Biden administration was, right? They're far more positive and embracing of it. And under the cover of the Trump administration, I feel like there's been a lot of progress made in terms of institutional mainstream acceptance of Bitcoin. And and I would argue that is good for Bitcoin.
It's interesting though, this idea of elites and counter elites, it still exists in the realm of politics, let's say. It's a political project. And I think one of the other threads of enlightenment and modernity and science is that we can solve the riddle of history. And this is, I think you see this in things like free market fundamentalism, that we don't need to think about politics anymore, the free market will fix it. Or you see this with something like communist ideology, that, you know, we don't need to think about politics anymore, we can move beyond that, there is a political struggle, but then we get to this post-material abundant utopia. You know, there's this idea that we can perfect the human institution, that we can get it right. And I think this reveals quite a lot of hubris. And I know this is something we've talked about before in terms of humanism and this faith in what we are able to build. And I wonder whether this elite and counter-elite, is this no different than, you know, is there nothing new under the sun? Is this the same?
Absolutely, I would argue that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And that's a great point, because I think we're on the same page there. And that, for me, any project that seeks to perfect the human experience or human society, right? Like you say, communists, we're going to be in this post-scarcity utopia where, you know, everyone's going to be working because they want to, or everyone's going to be happy. It's like, it's so naive and it's so misunderstanding of the human condition, and hubristic. I would say I just think that's a Tower of Babel from the Genesis story, that, you know, as you say, nothing new under the sun. Humans have always had these hubristic sort of projects where they think they can build a tower to heaven, which I would argue is an analogy for what we're saying is creating a utopia on Earth. And the tower always collapses in the end because it's flawed from the beginning, right? And the problem is that the human, I think Dostoevsky wrote about this. It wasn't in any of the books that I read of Dostoevsky's. I read The Underground Man, The Crime and Punishment, and The Brothers Karamazov. But I think it was Jordan Peterson who mentioned that in some of his writings, he said, you know, if you did create the conditions of utopia, you know, mankind would rebel within days and would want to tear it all down. Because there's something of the human which requires to strive, right? It's not about being happy. It's about the destination. It's about trying to be happy. You regulate your emotions through future expectation of happiness, right? Mm-hmm. So the utopia arriving is actually a problem. But I heard it put in a different way that the myth of Sisyphus, who was cursed to push his rock up a, right? He actually enjoyed that. He was happy.
Well, I think it was Albert Camus who said, though, we must imagine that Sisyphus enjoyed it.
Yeah,
he had to enjoy it, because if he didn't, what is there to believe? Yeah. Interesting. Well, I wonder whether there's some more things we can pull on here, though, because when we're in this world of elites and counter elites, we are existing within a political framework which is certainly for many thousands of years, since certainly the time of Rome, you know, we've had these kinds of power structures and civilizational systems. I think it's maybe a slightly more further away from our imagining when we look at, say, tribal life. It's maybe quite hard for us to think about that, but certainly civilizations and cities and these kinds of things. Over the last several thousand years, you know, there's been common trends. There's been waxing and waning. There's the development, the failure, the collapse of empire. But again, we come back to maybe the material reality of technology and how that can play positive roles. I mean, certainly living conditions, our medical experience, the life we live today, I mean, it's markedly different to the old days. In part because of technology, and that seems to be the piece that is always sitting there. When we face problems, we can use our intuition, our creativity to build solutions. And so maybe there's tension there, though, because that leads to hubris that somehow we can build the solution to all problems.
It's fascinating, right? Because have you ever read, Unabomber? I never get that right. Unabomber, right?
The Unabomber Manifesto?
Manifesto.
Industrial Society and its... I forgot the full title.
Ted
Kaczynski.
And what's the opening of that? It's the Industrial Revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race. Yeah, I think it was the opening line. I would argue that, and you mentioned it earlier, but it was the original sin was agriculture, and I also said it earlier, but it seems like a great idea, right? You're like, you know, we have this food insecurity problem. We have to go out and hunt mammoth or whatever when we're hungry. What if we just had this, you know, we planted seeds and we just let the sun do the work and we just collected the harvest at the end of the year and life's going to be good. We're going to be living in a utopia, right? And that's a technology, of course. But then you get these third, fourth order effects, which nobody considered at the time, which is now we need a standing army. Now we have game theory problem because I've got a standing army, you've got a standing army. You know,
I wonder whether that because there is certainly, I mean, I have friends who are in this world of things like permaculture that are interested in, I guess, the more return to earth kind of ideas. Yeah. And having, you know, grown up in a rural area, there is a reality to the fact that you need to farm if you want to feed people. You can't just let the seeds grow wild. It doesn't really work that way.
And just to be clear, I'm not saying farming's a bad idea. So this is why it's such a complicated thing, because... Look, of course you have to embrace the technology. If you don't, so this happened, right? So the Egyptians, were more advanced farmers than the rest of the region, and then they dominated that part of the world, right? And so, you could talk about agriculture, you could talk about the Industrial Revolution, you could talk about all the things Ted Kaczynski talked about in that, or even, you know, since Ted Kaczynski, you've got now the AI. Revolution, right? And it's like, would it be better for humanity if we didn't have AI? I would argue probably we'd probably be happier. Is it an option to say no?
Cat's out of the bag.
No, because now we've got the game theory problem. Now, if we don't do it and China does, then China dominates us.
Well, I want to bring in now at this juncture our conversation about faith and belief, because I feel, you know, we can get to this stage of the conversation where we're, you know, there is an inevitability, and this is what we're talking about before, the network state, you know, this technological determinism somehow. Yeah. You know, we've come this far with the internet and computers. It's going to keep going. We're all going to live in these little sort of boats out on the ocean and free market cities and kind of live in this kind of technological fantasy.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think the thing that is missing from all of these questions is a metaphysical take, right? We're talking about mega political forces. We're talking about resources and material here and now. But coming to the question of the metaphysical, of the question of the spirit, I'd be interested to understand, if as much as you're willing to share, your coming to faith and how it relates to this timeline of also understanding Bitcoin, and if there's a correlation or if they're separate things.
Yeah, I'd say it was separate. So I mean, I was born and raised, you know, within the church, within the Catholic Church originally, and so, you know, now I've always had faith. I went through a period of getting into the new atheists for a few years, where I lost my faith a little bit. It was fairly brief, though. I was under the influence of Dawkins, Hitchens, Harris, and
what appealed to you at that time about them?
That's a very good question. I don't know. I think it was just kind of cool, right? Because it was back when, I guess, like, the whole internet thing was just kind of taking off, in terms of, you know, you could watch those guys debate and stuff, and like Hitchens seemed so smart, and Harris and et cetera, they're so eloquent, and I guess they look cool, right? It must have been probably something as base as that. But so I read all of their books, I watched all of their debates and videos, and I was kind of influenced and thought they had a point. And but then you know, you get older, you read a lot more, you go back, you revisit the debates, and you realize how shallow they actually were. So I've always had faith, and I believe that, and you could bring up the Lindy effect to some extent, right? Is it the Lindy effect where something's been around for a long time, it's likely to be something like that, right? So for me, ultimately, the question I have to put to anyone who dismisses the Bible or the Christian faith is, you know, why is it that for generations, going back as far as we can, going back to the prehistory, going back to a time when it was incredibly expensive, for example, to write things down, right? Before you have the printing press, when you need to make papyrus, and when you need to, you know, have scribes write these things. Why is it that people felt it was important enough to reproduce this text, to earnestly teach it to their young? And you have this unbroken line of generations of people who have passed down this faith, preserved and passed down this faith against all sorts of persecutions. And you can imagine the kind of things they were dealing with, wars, famine. And yet, amongst all that, there's this unbroken chain where people have seen such value in this book to preserve and pass it to their progeny. And I feel the same way about the Bible, through, you know, obviously there's my upbringing, but just through my own reading into it, and little things like, you know, and Jordan Peterson talks about this in his, he's done this lecture series on the Bible. I don't know if you've watched it. It's quite interesting, but, you know, he was the one that really drew my attention to the fact that you can take the Cain and Abel story, for example, and it's something like, what, it's like 10 lines. I don't know. It's like several lines, right? But you can spend your whole life contemplating this. And Peterson's idea about that is that originally this story was kind of, I guess, transmitted verbally before it was written down. And there was this process whereby people, it's almost like an evolutionary process, ironically enough, where, you know, to do that is very expensive. And so there's this kind of evolutionary pressure to compact the information into as smaller amount of information as possible. And so basically what we've got with these, especially the earlier books of the Bible, is just this so much meaning condensed into so few lines. And then once I'd seen that and thought about it, and then I started to see Cain and Abel everywhere. in terms of, in my opinion, Breaking Bad is a retelling of the Cain and Abel story. Have you seen Breaking Bad?
Yes.
Right? Or the film Seven is a kind of clever inversion of it, because in my opinion, I don't want to ruin, anyone who hasn't seen Seven, turn off now, but like, Kevin Spacey is the Cain figure in that movie, but he goes one step further than Cain. He doesn't kill Abel. He has Abel kill him. And so he kills Abel in a different way, sort of a spiritual way. It's fascinating to me to think about that. But like, yeah, so you know, this book has so much meaning and so much value to so many people over so many generations, and there just has to be something there. And so for me, that's, I guess, has always been there, and it's just grown as I've got older, as I've thought about it more. And it's completely separate to Bitcoin. And the only way it really relates to Bitcoin for me is that I see people getting people who are not Christian, for example, or don't have that kind of faith. I see people getting religious about Bitcoin, and I see people pinning their hopes on Bitcoin in a way that I think is folly, and is kind of idol worship. And is dangerous. I noticed that within the Bitcoin community, and it's something that turns me off a little bit from the Bitcoin community.
I wonder if, thank you for sharing that. I wonder if there's a connection though, where the mathematical underpinning, there's this kind of, there is a sense of purity and I mean mathematical truth to Bitcoin that is quite profound. And I wonder, when we look into the history of the development of Christianity, over time, this merging of the idea of Jewish law and Greek natural philosophy is really one of the powerful pieces. And this is this kind of always this tension between faith and rationality that I think has been part of the driving dynamic of Christianity over time, is that it's the search for truth within the law, and then the search for law within and kind of the natural truth of the world around us. And so we see the development of the early universities coming out of the church. We've always seen this push and pull, and it's almost like when you have that aha moment with Bitcoin, that sense that there's a universal kind of, you know, in a Platonic idea of the form of the good, you know, touching mathematics in its pure form, in a sense is an allusion to touching God, and or at least seeing like a glimmer of the light. And whether that, when you sort of focus on the ray of light, you're not looking at the actual sun, or you're not looking at the actual source of the light. And so maybe there's a little bit of confusion there. That is, I think, you know, we can remedy that with you know, instruction. But it seems like maybe there's something there. Once you kind of feel that energy of some kind of truth, you search for the ultimate truth, perhaps.
Yeah, when you said about I forgot how you put it, but something about the mathematical, profound mathematical truth of Bitcoin, something like that. Could you dig into that?
Yeah, so I think we talk about proof of work, bridging digital and physical world. There's some pretty profound ideas which is why people go down the rabbit hole, I think. You know, this isn't just
maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I'm thinking as you're saying that.
For me, certainly, like, wow, this is... this is something, you know, that
something new.
Right? We can cryptographically secure this thing for all time.
Sure.
That the bitcoins are out there, but they're not. You don't have access to them. There's some some truths there that are quite big ideas to grapple with. That maybe a lot of people haven't grappled with.
Fair enough. So maybe I'm being a little uncharitable, right? Because there is a genuine kind of philosophical component to this thing, which could be
you can meditate on it, right?
On it. But so that's fine. It's the worshipping of it, that the whole, like, you know, once Bitcoin hits a million, everything's going to be okay, kind of thing. Which I guess there's the fact that people LARP. I feel like people LARP the philosophy thing in a little bit, because what they really want is Bitcoin to be $1 million, but they don't want to say that because it sounds crass. So they'll talk about, you know, the mother goddess of proof of work,
the time chain.
Right. You know, and I guess that is what I kind of. I'm probably being a bit uncharted.
No, I understand, and I think let's also situate this in this world we live in today, where, I mean, what is truth? You know, this is the question Pontius Pilate asks Jesus. What is truth? You know, what are we doing here? What is going on? We live in, for the most part, a secular world. We're driven by, you know, algorithms. Our lives are computed, and we are numbers on a spreadsheet. You know, my number, social security. You know, a lot of these things mean that it is easy to maybe frame ourselves as simply beings here on Earth doing things, and ignore this kind of divine imminence, this absolute profoundness of that there is a God,
right.
And it's here with us. He is with us here. You know, that's quite a confronting idea in our modern world, I think.
Yeah, and I think you can avoid it as well, I think, in our modern world, because, you know, you've always got, for example, electronic lights, and you can always kind of, and you've got now even with computers and YouTube, and you just never kind of alone with the profundity of it all, right? You know, can you imagine the ancients, our forefathers, what have you, when they were under a starry sky and just staring into that, and it just must have seemed obvious to them. Whereas for us, we're not really confronted with that.
We're distracted from distraction by distraction. And we don't see, and every time we get the little sort of glimpse of something, or we're going to pull out our phone,
it's uncomfortable.
Or we're going to fill it with some noise.
Yeah.
And this is one of my own personal foibles, is I really struggle with phones and mobile phones, and especially in Japan.
We all do. Yeah.
For me, actually, vicariously seeing other people on their phone as if they're hooked on opium in the 19th century, as if they can't. I go to the gym. They can't not touch it.
We are. I mean, I'm using we because I'm sure I'm part of that. But this is another fascinating thing, right? The whole, because we know the social media companies are deliberately engineering their products to hit those whatever dopamine receptors and whatever, and actually, as you say, like, have people addicted to these as if they're addicted to opium. So this is by design.
They call it the hypodermic theory of media for a reason.
Yeah.
And I do wonder whether, you know, in a bigger sense, our distraction, and maybe it started with radio and television and the emergence of these kind of broadcast media, but that is that getting in the way of finding the truth, the real truth, with a capital T?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it is. Going back to the neck tattooed brethren, you know, I don't think many of them care.
I don't have a problem with neck tattoos, actually. But, it's a good, I understand, though. There's a sort of a roughness to it. There's an aggressiveness kind of implicit.
They used to be. Now it just seems to be some sort of fat, like it's wearing a shirt or something. These people aren't like, it used to be, you saw someone with a neck tattoo and you didn't mess with them because that was sending out a signal that I don't care about social convention, right? Now it's like some sort of fashion statement. I don't know what's going on.
Well, I wonder whether another way of framing this, is it the reemergence of barbarism? And
tattoo?
Or this kind of way of living, of your phone blasting music out on the public transport, of the kind of, let's say, that general inconsiderate behavior. Are you familiar with Giorgio Agamben, his writing? So he's a theorist who wrote extensively about the COVID era.
Oh.
And he's got this book, The Epidemic as Politics, which I reference quite a lot. And he sort of argues from a Christian perspective that COVID was really the turning point to barbarism for the West, where we elevated the body above the soul. And it left quite an impression on me that, you know, we
so that's his definition of barbarism. It's sort of pre-Christian kind of hedonistic sort of paganism kind of thing. Okay.
Yeah, but in particular though, the idea that the body was above the soul, and that you know your flesh and your sort of drinking and merrymaking was more important. And we sort of saw that with COVID, where you couldn't go to a funeral, you couldn't go to church, you couldn't get out of the house to save your body, to save your life, when actually your soul was withering away on the inside.
Mm.
And so he's got some quite powerful philosophical writings on this. And I do wonder whether, are we seeing this kind of emergence of barbarism? You know, when was the last time you went through a major international airport and you see this kind of, you know, maybe we have a certain privileged perspective of the world, but, you know, for a lot of people, it is Instagram and algorithms and YouTube and living for the moment, right?
Yeah, and I guess it's always been that way to some extent. I'm not sure. I mean, I guess, barbarism maybe was some sort of pre-Christian thing, right? Where, you know, whether we call it barbarism or not, it's this, for me, it's more like this, you know, materialistic thing, materialistic in the sense that the belief that there's nothing beyond the material.
Yes, exactly.
Which is a feature I think of. I think our elites think in those ways. I think essentially, yeah. I think most people, you know, university educated, most. I don't know about most, but certainly there's a certain significant percentage of the elites who think along those lines. Like probably Elon Musk doesn't believe in a soul. I don't know. I'm speculating. But it would be surprising me if he did spend much time thinking about souls.
Well, it's interesting, though, because when you look at, say, traditional tribal religions of animism, of forest spirits and these kinds of things that exist and emerge throughout societies in different places, they are imminently connected to things, right? There is a materialism there. Mm. And I think one of the profound dynamics of the Christian faith is that there is both an eternal truth beyond a metaphysical truth, but then it is also imminent. He came down here into this fallen world.
That's one of the fascinating things about Christianity is that the whole emphasis on the resurrection of the body. It's not, as you say, it's not just the soul, but the body. It's the merging of the two, right? It's the insistence on that, which I always found very interesting.
What do you mean? Like,
so post-resurrection, we will be embodied, we will be incorporeal. It's very clearly, you know, if you're a Christian of an orthodox sort, lower orthodox, then you profess, is that the right verb? The Apostles' Creed, which states clearly that we believe in the resurrection of the body. So that's an interesting insistence, because a lot of people who are less maybe educated about Christianity, for example, they have this vague idea of the soul, and they maybe imagine themselves sort of wispy soul-like floating around in heaven after death. But that isn't the historical orthodox understanding of...
I believe in the Holy Spirit, the Holy Catholic Church, the communion of saints... The forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting. Amen.
There you go.
Okay, so we've got this interesting dynamic of both the physical imminent here and now, but also this eternal truth. And I think one of the profound concepts, which I think is a little bit more pronounced perhaps in Catholicism and in the Eastern tradition, but the idea of the upper room, which I was studying actually this morning, the upper room of the Last Supper.
Oh.
And kind of in our minds, you know, it was a physical space, but in our minds, what does that also mean as a spiritual space? What does it mean for us to step up, to climb the ladder, to climb the stairs up into that upper room of a higher place, of a higher plane? And again, it's just a little detail that maybe people haven't thought about, but it wasn't on the ground floor. It was on the upper.
I never thought about that.
In the upper room.
Right.
And I mean, if, as you say, you can spend your whole life reading the Abel and Cain, but I mean, the entire Bible, it's all music. There's no noise.
And, absolutely, yeah.
And so this idea of like stepping up and the apostles coming up into the upper room to commune, but then that Jesus himself came down to earth to do the work. And that dynamic, I think, is really powerful. That it's not a static kind of frozen in time thing, even though there is an aspect of it which is eternal and unchanging, but there's like a dynamism there. There's like a motion, kind of if you know what I mean. It's sort of, it flows.
I think so, yeah. I think I know.
We can go up into the room and he came down.
Yeah. It's very profound. It's very hard to put into words. But I guess, and I don't want to be, I want to be very careful to avoid heresy here, so I'm not...
it's okay.
But...
well, it's not okay, but yeah.
It's not, heresy's not okay, but yeah, I guess to steel man the kind of idea that Bitcoin is profound on that level, in the same, we can talk about it in the same breath, right? The idea of proof of work mining, kind of bringing the digital and the physical world together is perhaps a similar kind of thing as this.
It sort of unlocks, you know, it gets you thinking about things. It's like, oh, wow, what does that mean? Wow. You know, it sort of is thought-provoking, let's say. And I would just argue, I would say as well that we don't have to maybe think about Bitcoin in this kind of metaphysical, kind of spiritual sense, but what we can maybe think about it is, you know, if we look at other parts of, even, you know, the Lord's Prayer, you know, are we done on earth as it is in heaven? What does it mean to have technology or providential tools and things made available to us here to let's say, fix, and that's kind of maybe problematic, but to bring about a better kind of world. And
yeah, we're back to that. So to get back to Ted Kaczynski, you know, it's complicated, right? Because as I say, there's a game theoretic dynamic, which means you need to embrace this technology. I happen to think, from a theological point of view, that our use of technology is essentially is the original sin, I think, or our use of technology flows from the original sin. And so I think, you know, for example, in heaven, in the New Jerusalem, I don't think there will be any technology. I don't think there'll be any AI. We'll have everything that we had everything we needed in the garden, right? We had the fruit growing on the trees, and the whole idea of rebelling against God and disobeying God and going for the forbidden fruit, I think, you know, you could argue that that was essentially the first step into manipulating the physical world in ways that we thought we could improve it. You know, we're fixing God's imperfect creation. That's the original sin. So then you have agriculture, then you have the Industrial Revolution, then you have AI. And so I think ultimately we have to, you know, but then I also recognize providence, right? So, you know, God is in control, and this idea there's a flow of history, and God is the author of history. So, you know, it's a very complicated thing. But I think ultimately we have to, you know, post Christ's return, we have to come to the understanding, we will be of the understanding that, you know, all of this technology was folly. It was chasing after wind, you know, as the preacher may have said. And that's my personal belief. And that's a very impractical sort of belief, because we live in a world, you know, for example, I've spent the last 6 months very much deep diving on AI. and I have my own open claw and I'm absolutely embracing this technology. So I'm somewhat of a hypocrite, right? Mm. But as Hitchens used to put it, you know, I think it's important to be able to keep two sets of books. You need to be able to work with contradictory ideas and things in your mind, because we live in a very complicated world. I don't know if that answers your question, but I don't believe that we're going to be ushering in any kind of utopia. I don't think technology leads us to anywhere good. Ultimately, you know, the only thing that we can save us is faith in Christ as our Lord and Savior, in my opinion. And you know, technology is kind of a distraction or a kind of folly or whatever, or a kind of vanity. That's my belief.
I understand. Well, look, I appreciate that. I think there's, as I say, maybe we can hold these ideas in both hands. That I think one of the kind of the idyllic life of our modern world of having modern medicine and electricity and all these things, in a sense that alongside this kind of eternal kind of state of nature has political connotations, but this relationship to say the garden of Eden, this kind of time immemorial ancient history. Those two things, I think, can sort of sit alongside each other, because, you can't give up in the Ted Kaczynski way and just go and live in the forest in this world.
It's even worse with him. He didn't give up. He actively tried to stop it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, to be very clear, I do not endorse Ted.
No, it's just a good point. and maybe what we're saying here in this format of conversation, it's maybe hard to express. We can sort of touch on it. We can allude to it. But again, one of the other concepts that I've actually found quite valuable from the Eastern tradition, just in my studies, is the idea of the mysterion.
When you say the Eastern tradition, you mean Eastern Orthodoxy?
Yeah.
I'm not very familiar with that, but educate me.
So I'm you know, I just find it curious to look into this every now and then and see kind of different approaches to things as it relates to my tradition. And one of the ideas they have is of the mysterion. They don't necessarily use the kind of approach towards trying to understand the Eucharist as a scientific process, for example. They just say, look, it is what it is. It's a mysterion. We can meditate on the Trinity. We can meditate on the Eucharist.
I think the Catholic Church is similar, right?
A little, yeah, it's similar. Like, there's still some, I guess, theology around how it works, whereas I feel like and again, that's just my lay take on it, but there seems to be like a bit more it is what it is. And for us, you know, look, we're here on Earth. We're here and now. I've got a very interesting proposition for you or idea. Why is it that we're here 2,000 years later?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, year 2000, I remember, but wouldn't the 2000th anniversary of the crucifixion and the resurrection be a much more compelling date for us to consider, which is only a few years away? What does that mean for you and me being here right now? We're not. It's not 500 years ago. It's not in the future.
I hadn't thought about that.
We could say arguably.
So that would be 2033, 33 maybe. To 36. We don't, or something like that.
Something like that.
Right.
So what does it mean for you and I to be here right now, given that we are the hands and feet of God?
Elon Musk would say we're in a simulation. But that's the question, right?
And what work do we need to do on Earth to prepare the way?
Yes.
What is our mission? What is our Great Commission? And I think that when you start thinking about it like that, that's a bit more of a wow moment. You know, we're not born in the 18th century.
No, it is.
We've got...
It's a call to art, or to arm, for want of a better expression. It's a call to action, right? It's a very, very powerful idea.
And this is where, again, I'm trying to consider with this show, with my own work, man, like, what am I supposed to do except preach the gospel and my actions.
Well, I think that's it, right? Baptize in the name of the Father and Son. Baptize all nations in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or whatever. Yeah, I mean, that's, I guess that's what it must be. But you know, how to go about doing that? Right? And what's the most effective way to go about?
And
doing that?
You know, I just you look at what's going on. You know, we monitoring the situation, the geopolitics of it all. We've got this thing, Bitcoin, that maybe we can use as a providential tool.
Yeah.
I think that's quite a powerful idea to work with, that we can maybe set apart ourselves so that we don't have to participate in the global KYC panopticon if we don't want to, maybe.
Well, yeah, you probably have to. You'll have your free self and you'll have your KYC self, right?
Yeah.
You live in two worlds.
A bit of dynamism there. and I don't know, man. I feel like there's something for us. We can meditate on is what does it mean for us to be here and now. You know, Bitcoin maybe is part of the story, but there's a lot of other things going on. And what does that mean in terms of action? Maybe we can come back to this idea of not just the idea, but what does it mean to put it into action? What does it mean to live your faith?
I'm looking for that, actually, to be honest.
Oh, really?
I think that's the absolute question that we need to be asking ourselves now. We need to be coming up with answers because there's a malaise in the West, even within Christendom. And people, even within Christendom, right, don't seem certain about what their role is or what the church's role is or any of this. And we're lacking leadership, we're lacking direction, we're lacking ideas to some extent. And so, yes, absolutely, I think you're asking the right question there. And I've been thinking a lot about this myself, and I don't have the answers, but I don't know how long we can keep saying that. It seems our generation as well. We've spent a long time like blaming the prior generation, or talking about how the boomers have screwed everything up, and maybe they have. But it's like, when are we actually going to stand up and start putting forward our vision of how things should be? And to your point, this whole, you know, stop with the ideas and start with the action, right? To circle back to the sort of earlier conversation.
Yeah, no, it is profound, and I think maybe to summarize, the things we've really covered, there is a material reality. I mean, we're here in time and space, but what does it mean to retreat into that upper room? What does it mean to meditate upon the mysterion, upon the Trinity, upon the magnificent conception of life? Not that we live in the shadows, or that we're not nothing, but we are in fact the hands and feet of God, that the Lord is imminent inside us, that the Holy Spirit walks with us everywhere that we go, that we've been given this chance to carry the light, and that we can in fact bring about profound love in this world, that we can love our neighbors as ourselves, we can carry out the commandments, follow the commandments. And I think that there is a path to salvation ultimately, and that's maybe the big piece when we're talking about material world, about these things. None of it leads to salvation. There's nothing there that can redeem your soul.
It's the gospel, it's the good news.
So that is the good news that has always been proclaimed. And so I thank you for your time, man, coming down to the studio.
Yeah, thank you. It's been fun. Yeah,
thank you.
It's been a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.